Professor Buzz Scher dives into the overturning of the Boston Marathon bomber's death sentence. This is The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law. Now accepting applications for JD, graduate programs, and online professional certificates. Learn more and apply at law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was previously sentenced to death for his taking part in the Boston Marathon bombing that was in 2013. Can you tell me a bit more about that case?
He was the sole remaining defendant. Obviously, his brother was died in a shootout. So he was the only one charged with the death sentence, death eligible case, capital cases. He ended up having 30 charges against him. Not all 30 were capital cases. The ones that included the death of people were capital cases. He went to trial. He was convicted on all 30. Now, his defense lawyers never, other than some minor charges, which I'll talk about in a minute, his defense lawyers never contested whether he was guilty of the offenses. They fought at the, once he was convicted of those charges, they fought it as to whether the death penalty should be imposed. And, you know, what a jury does in those cases, a sentencing jury does in those cases, is they the prosecution notices up a list of aggravating factors that they think are at play in the case. And the defense notices up mitigating factors, and the defense during trial can add additional mitigating factors. And then it's up to the jury to do a balancing process governed by statute, weighing the aggravate, deciding how many have they proven the aggravators sufficiently, and two, have they proved any mitigators sufficiently, and then balancing if there are aggravators that have been proven, balancing the aggravators and the mitigators. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of how that balancing occurs, but it's a very sophisticated process that was developed federally at that level in the about 40, 45 years ago in the new wave of capital statutes. Defense in their appeal did not really challenge the Constitution. They challenged, but without any success, the constitutionality of that sentencing scheme. In the appeal, they had several issues on appeal. The one that they won on in terms of the capital sentence, the death sentence, was the judge's failure to do sufficient screening of the jurors prior to the selection of the jurors. The same jurors sat on the guilt phase and on the sentencing phase. And the judge didn't, given the pretrial publicity of the case, given that in the Boston, Cambridge, Somerville area, those communities, portions of those communities were locked down, the judge did not do sufficient screening of jurors before jurors were selected. Specifically in this case, there was one juror who was locked down. And after the lockdown, he started tweeting about his experience and about the case, over 24 tweets. And in one of his tweets, he called the Dzhokhar Tsarnaev a piece of garbage. The judge basically screened the jurors that the number, first of all, the defense asked for a change of venue. That is, let's try this case somewhere other in the district, the federal district, where people were locked down and where it was all over the news for God knows how long. Move it to Springfield.
Yeah, it's completely shocking that it took place in Boston.
Exactly. And so, you know, one thing the judge said, no, I can screen the jurors sufficiently to cure any problems. So they asked her, did you know anything about this? But he wouldn't let the defense lawyers ask the individual jurors that were being interviewed, what did you find out about, what did you learn, what do you remember from the media when this was going on? And how did that affect you? And the judge just got, they didn't, the judge did not let them, the defense lawyers asked those questions to delve down into the details of what was the nature of their exposure to the media and what was the extent of their exposure to the media. He just got them to say yes to the question, can you put aside any feelings you have about this case and make your decision only based on the evidence? And jurors would say yes to that. You know, most jurors would say yes to that. Most jurors, in my experience, don't say, no, I can't be fair. You know, although, you know, I've done individual voir dire in murder, first degree murder cases in New Hampshire, and there are some jurors who say, you know, I just, what I know about this case, I can't be fair. So that was the failing. And it was put in high relief when the guy I talked about, he became the foreperson of the jury. So there's not, you know, there's very well established case law in the First Circuit Court of Appeals, where the appeal was held, that says when you have a high publicity case, you've got to figure out with each juror the extent of their exposure to the media and the nature of their exposure and how it affected them. It's not, you know, it's not surprising case law. It's pretty standard case law. And the judge clearly did not do that when he prohibited the defense lawyers from asking that question. And so it really, in that sense, it's not surprising at all that the death sentence was overturned and got sent back for another sentencing hearing. That it's also surprising that it got overturned because death sentences don't usually get overturned that frequently. So, you know, it's both surprising and not surprising. It's a technical legal matter, not surprising at all, but as a, you know, just at a more, a broader level, you know, it's, you don't see that very often, particularly in a jurisdiction like the First Circuit, where you don't see these cases very often. And so the prosecutors are very careful.
Now, what sort of previous cases could you reference as being a prime example of this being avoided in the past? I mean, there's been some domestic terrorism cases previously that I'd imagine where they took precautions to make sure things like this didn't happen.
Yeah, many of those cases are not capital cases, but really there's no difference. If it's a high publicity case, there's no difference between a capital case and a first degree murder case or any kind of case. You want to make sure, you know, in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Constitution, for example, says you are entitled to jurors who are as fair as the lot of humanity will allow. It's a wonderful description of fairness and what you aspire to. And, you know, the federal constitution entitles you to fair jurors and fair judges. So it's not unusual at all for judges to take precautions in screening jurors in high publicity cases. The two most common ways to take precautions is to change the venue, send it someplace else. It's really simple. You know, it costs the court a little more money, but really they got to try the case somewhere, so it's not going to cost the court that much more money. Really, you know, it's just the judge goes someplace else and sits there and does it, or another judge does it in another jurisdiction, be it spring, particularly in a federal court, and send it to any federal jurisdiction in the country. You don't need to even send it to Springfield, the other jurisdiction. You can send it to Connecticut. You can send it to New Hampshire. You could send it to upstate New York. You know, you could send it to Arizona. It doesn't really matter because it's a federal case, and the law in all those jurisdictions are the same. It's a little harder at the state level to change venue. You can send a Manchester case to Coos County or a Dover case to Cheshire County to change venue if there's high publicity in that jurisdiction. But the other way to do it is to screen the jurors carefully. And it just takes time. You know, the problem with screening jurors carefully is it takes time. When I was trying first degree murder cases and we were doing the kind of voir dire, which is the screening process for jurors, means to say the truth, it would take to pick a jury of 14, 12 and two alternates for a first degree murder case. I've taken 2 or 3 weeks to do that. It's just a laborious, difficult, challenging process. And courts get grumpy about it because it takes up so much time and it costs money because you're bringing in a number of jurors that you have to pay their juror fee for the day. It's not much, but it accumulates when you bring in a panel of 200 jurors and you screen out 120 of them because they know too much about the case just by asking them general questions. And they say, I can't be fair about this, by raising their hand. And then you're left with 80, and then you go through the individual process and you get maybe three jurors that are acceptable to both sides out of that process. So it's expensive. It's inefficient. It feels inefficient. So that's the pressure on judges to, let's just get on with it. I'm not going to let you do all this questioning. So that's really what was going on in that case.
So what's the next steps for the Zinaev sentencing? I'm assuming they're going to have to find a new jury to do the sentencing over again.
Yeah, actually, there's a couple steps before that. The prosecution has this decision was issued by a three-judge panel of the First Circuit. All appeals, with the rarest of circumstances, that go to appeal from federal district court to the First Circuit are heard in the first instance by a panel of three judges. They come out with their ruling. The losing party then has the opportunity to ask for an en banc hearing, a rehearing of the appeal in front of the full First Circuit panel of judges, like 9 or 12, I forgot how many there are now currently on the First Circuit. And so the prosecution has that option. They can file and ask for a rehearing for the whole panel of First Circuit judges. Or they can try and go directly to the from the three court panel. They can try and go directly three judge panel. They can try and go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, but likely they'll ask for the panel en banc panel before they try and go to the Supreme Court. So that needs to play out whether they're going to do that or not. Then they go. Assuming the ruling stands in some fashion, then they'll have to pick a whole new jury in a better fashion for a new sentencing hearing. Or the prosecution can say, look, it's not worth it. We can live with him being in jail for the rest of his life. On other charges, he's already gotten life without parole sentences. Whatever comes of this, he's going to serve the rest, as the court made clear in its opinion, he's going to serve the rest of his life in jail. So, you know, the prosecution can make that judgment.
Thanks for listening to The Legal Impact, presented by UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. To help spread word about the show, please be sure to subscribe and comment on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify.